Welcome to the Moses Organic Farming Podcast. This is Chuck from Moses. Today, we're checking in with Alyssa Hartman, the Executive Director of the Artisan Grain Collaborative, before hearing a conversation hosted by Amy Halloran with Lisa Kissing-Kusek and Julie Dawson. Amy works with AGC as the head of the Education and Outreach Working Group, and she's the author of The New Bread Basket, How the New Crop of Grain Growers, Plant Breeders, Millers, Maltsters, Bakers, Brewers, and Local Food Activists are Redefining Our Daily Loaf. In addition to working with AGC in the Midwest, she also works with the Northeast Grain Shed to create networks and support regional grains. Lisa and Julie are two research scientists and seed breeders who have been doing some great collaborative work with grain farmers to develop good grain varieties for food grade production in the Midwest. Let's get to it. Hey, Alyssa, how's it going?
Hi, Chuck. Going well. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Yeah, so thank you so much, first of all, for organizing along with Amy Halloran these episodes that are about to come out on food grade grains. So yeah, you're the executive director of AGC, which is the Artisan Grain Collaborative. Can you tell us a little bit more about how AGC works and kind of what the model is behind it?
AGC is currently a network of about 150, though we are growing every month, staple crop producers, processors, end users, and advocates working across the Midwest to regionalize food grade grain, dry bean, and other staple crop production for our region. So those big buckets I mentioned, producers, processors, end users, and advocates, includes farmers, millers, maltsters, bakers, chefs, brewers, distillers, food manufacturers, folks that work with spent grain, researchers, other affiliated nonprofit or support organizations like Moses is one of our members, as well as agricultural researchers. And we're going to be hearing from some of those folks, Julie Dawson and Lisa Kissing-Kusek, in our first episode here. And so this network, AGC, brings together these stakeholders working across the value chain to build relationships with one another, to be able to solve problems together, because it's one thing to talk about the theoretical of regionalizing staple crop production, but it's another to actually do that thing. And it requires a lot of different actors getting on the same page and building relationships together to be able to move to that possible system of the Midwest actually growing our local staple crops to feed the community. So we bring people together, we provide technical resources and assistance for folks working across this value chain, and we also focus on public education around grain and other staple crop systems as essential parts of local and regional food economies.
Do you want to share a bit about how you came to work in food grade grain in the Midwest?
Yeah, so I started my role in August 2019 as the first director and full-time staff of the Artisan Grain Collaborative. And I, probably like many people, maybe not all of our listeners of these podcasts who are likely much more astute than I was, food grade grain really had not been a big part of my life prior to coming to AGC. I did spend a little less than a year working at a cooking school in Sicily, where the school grew a lot of wheat in particular for bread and pasta production, as well as a wide variety of lentils. But my background is in local and regional food systems generally, as well as in environmental organizing. And food grade grain is not something that I was thinking about as a critical part of healthy local and regional food systems. And I realize now, almost 2 years into this role with AGC, how mistaken I was, because these systems for staple crop production are absolutely critical to the health of rural economies, to food security, They are essential tools to improving our agricultural landscapes in the Midwest and the environmental resilience of those landscapes. So while I didn't have a direct path to food grade grains, I am now one of their biggest fans, I would say.
Me too. I actually, right before we sat down to record this, I made a loaf of bread using flour from AGC members, Meadowlark Organics. So I've also grown to love it as well. So I'm a member of AGC through Moses, and we were in a meeting the other day, and it struck me because there was some sort of not super contentious issue, but like people were kind of disagreeing about something. And there were people from across the entire value chain in the same meeting. And it was getting close to the end of the meeting, and you interjected and said, "Isn't this great that we have these difficult conversations and collaborate in this way?" And then I was thinking, it's like, this is the only time, these AGC meetings are the only time when I'm in meetings with everyone across a whole value chain, from the seed breeder researcher folks through the farmers and the bakers and the millers and the distillers and like everybody. So I just think it's like a super unique model that I've seen do really valuable work. And so I appreciate what you are doing, and I'm really thankful to get to share a little bit more through this podcast series. So thank you for the work you do, and thank you for helping to organize these things.
Well, we are so glad that you are a part of it. And thanks so much for offering your platform through these podcasts. I think it's going to be really neat to get to have these upcoming conversations, because while buzz is certainly building and awareness is building around food grade grains, there still is a significant gap in resources, especially print resources and information that's easily and readily accessible to farmers without knowing the cell phone number of somebody who is growing food grade grain. So I think these conversations are a great step in the direction of making some of the knowledge of people who have been early adopters of food grade grains, particularly geared toward local value-added markets, and getting that know-how and those learnings out to a wider audience. So I think this is great. And one thing that's really interesting to think about is AGC was really born with a focus on small grains in particular, which are things like wheat, oats, barley, rye. Those crops were incredibly common in this region up until about 100 years ago. And then there has been an enormous decline in production of those crops as more acres has gone into corn and soy. And as we've made that transition to more corn and soy acreage, we've lost a lot of diversity on the landscape, which has had adverse impacts in terms of soil quality and health, water infiltration, which is a huge issue for public works and publicly funded civic engineering projects through increases in flooding. And we've also moved into a system in which fewer and fewer acres of our agricultural land in the region is feeding people. A lot more of it than there was in previous times is feeding livestock or feeding our cars. And so there's a real opportunity here to leverage small grains and other staple crops to add diversity back to our landscape. And we need to do that for farm viability, so farmers have more higher value markets to sell into. We need to do it for economic and environmental resilience. It is not a good policy to have so much of our land in so few crops. That's not good biologically. It's not good for the economies of our region. And also, a huge percentage of the grains that we all eat are not coming from this region. And there's no reason for that agronomically. We can grow these things. And there are plenty of food businesses in the area who are really excited to work with them. So I think this poses a huge opportunity for farms of all different stripes and scales, from small diversified vegetable operations to larger enterprises growing smaller rotations. I think there's something in food grade grains for almost any type of farm. So it'll be fun to get to hear from some of the folks working across our grain value chain in the region for more of their perspectives. And I'm also just really grateful to Amy Halloran, who coordinates our education and outreach working group, as well as being an incredible national grain advocate and author of a book called The New Breadbasket, which is all about regional grain systems, for leveraging her expertise and hosting these conversations with AGC members.
Thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for the work you're doing. And thank you to Amy Halloran as well for hosting these conversations. And we have this one and then two more to follow. So stay tuned and we'll get right to the episode.
Hi, I'm Amy Halloran, and I'm here today to talk with Julie Dawson and Lisa Kissing-Cusick for the Moses podcast series that AGC, the Artisan Grain Collaborative, is doing about grains. And today we're going to be talking about seeds. Lisa and Julie have great experience with seeds and seed breeding, and I think they're going to be terrific voices to help us understand what the heck we need to know in small grains. Lisa Kissing-Cusick is a plant research geneticist with the USDA ARS, and Julie Dawson is associate professor at the Department of Horticulture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Julie has done work at the University of Washington, so I tripped over my tongue there. But welcome, both of you, and thank you so much for joining me. So, Julie, why don't we start with you? Can you tell us about, I think I'd like you to illustrate your history with seeds. Then we can have a conversation about what is going on with seeds in Wisconsin.
Sure. Thank you for the invitation to participate in this. I first got interested in plant breeding and seeds actually in high school and was fortunate enough to work with a graduate student at Cornell University, Tim Porch, working with Molly John on a bean breeding project for Honduras. And then in grad school, I worked in wheat. So I got into wheat fairly early. I was at Washington State University working with Steve Jones on organic wheat breeding and looking at nitrogen use in organic wheat. And then I did a postdoc in France. I was really lucky to have the opportunity to work with Dr. Isabelle Coudranger at the National Institute for Agricultural Research there, and with the Réseau Semences Paysannes, which is the Farmer Seed Network. And we were breeding wheat in a participatory way for organic systems and for artisanal bread making quality. So that was a really great experience. I learned a lot from the farmers and from Isabel. I then came back to the US and worked at Cornell with Mark Sorrells on an organic wheat breeding project. And that's where I met Lisa. She came to Cornell as well to work on that project. And I've stayed involved with the wheat in a smaller way through the last few years. Here at UW-Madison, I mostly work on vegetable variety trials and vegetable breeding for organic systems. And I also have been continuing to work on the food grade grains and on breeding for artisanal bread making quality and organic adaptation in the upper Midwest. And that's in partnership with Lucia Gutierrez, who's the small grains breeder here at UW-Madison.
That's great. And while we have you, Julie, let's talk a little bit more in depth about the work that you did in France, because that was such a unique setup in terms of working directly with the farmers and with their seed needs in an environment that was very different from ours.
Yeah. So the environment was different, but there were a lot of similarities. And I think there are a couple things that I learned there that I've tried to carry through here in some of the work that I've been doing. The first was the participatory aspect. The farmers were very engaged in the research, and part of that was because of the seed regulations in Europe, and that's a a difference, I guess, in the environment, the broader environment, including social and economic factors. The seed regulations do not allow varieties to be sold unless they have gone through a registration process. And that registration process is usually done in conventional systems with higher inputs. And there's also a difference between Europe and the US in terms of wheat breeding, because in Europe, typically the conventional wheat breeding programs use higher levels of inputs than wheat breeding programs here, whether they're conventional or organic. And so we found in France and Europe that many of the wheat varieties that were bred in conventional systems that had gone through the registration process did not work well in organic environments because there was a large contrast between organic wheat production and conventional wheat production. And so we really had a network of growers who were extremely motivated to develop their own varieties. They also had to produce their own seed because they weren't allowed to commercialize varieties that didn't go through the registration process. And so they became seed producers as well as farmers and breeders. And really the project was driven by the farmer interest and by their priorities in terms of finding wheat varieties that did well in organic systems and also had really good artisanal bread making qualities. In France, that meant usually going back to some of the older varieties that had good adaptation and good bread making quality. And we made crosses. The farmers chose the parents they wanted to cross, and we helped facilitate that. And many times that was a cross between a historic variety and a more modern one, or two historic varieties with complementary characteristics. And then they would do the selection on farm. And we had a network of about 25 farms that were doing on-farm selection at that point.
I met you when you came back to the States after that experience. And I think that it worked really well in the Northeast, your experience as farmers were trying to get their footing with figuring out what was going to serve them in the emerging small grains markets.
Yeah, I think that there were a lot of similarities in the markets and in the desire to have more control over the whole process so that farmers were developing partnerships directly with millers and bakers. And that really leads to much more communication about what bakers need and what farmers need so that each side understands the other better. I think in the Northeast and in the Midwest, we have much harsher winters than in most of Europe until you get to Eastern Europe. And so we've been working with crosses in the breeding program of historic varieties from Europe that had really good bread making quality, and then adapted varieties from the Northeast and Canada mostly that had the winter hardiness and the production characteristics. And often actually in the US, some of the conventionally bred varieties do pretty well in organic systems because they've been bred under a low input condition. But I think the similarities in the marketing and in the desire to have a much better connection to millers and bakers and to the end consumer really is very similar between Europe and the US.
Right. And that really differs from the standard seed breeding practices that both of you have experienced in other settings. Lisa, can you describe for us a little bit how that works so that we can understand the contrast in what this level of seed work is doing?
In these new grain economies that we're seeing popping up, where you have a more local or regional system of a farmer supplying wheat that's going to go directly to a smaller mill, probably that goes directly to a consumer, is quite different from the typical system we've seen in really recent memory of the last few generations, where things have been really centralized and you get really large wheat production regions like in the Pacific Northwest and in the Great Plains or the Southern Great Plains. And all of that goes to very centralized milling facilities for really specific purposes and hits the food chain that way. And so there's this resurgence of local grain economies happening, where someone can buy either a loaf of bread or a bag of flour that's been grown and milled in a more local way, either, within their state or within a small group of states around them. it's pretty exciting. And organic growers have really led the way on this resurgence of local milling. But it is requiring very different needs from this centralized system of wheat production and milling and processing, because the consumers who want it are primarily in areas that are higher density living, right? Which are tend to be in the eastern U.S. or, you know, over in California, in areas that don't have as much wheat production as this big commercial chain does. So we then have turned to breeding and many other tools to say, all right, how can we produce wheat in these regions that haven't seen it or haven't seen red wheat, for example, for a long time? And that's where breeding kind of became useful to create or recreate varieties that can do well for that local bread economy and provide wheat products that people want in a typical wheat growing region.
Right. And for a different end user, the end user is either going to be a small scale bakery or someone at home. And when you're growing wheat or other grains for a factory condition where you want it to go into a loaf of bread that's going to hit the supermarket in a very, very large scale way, it's totally different goals.
Yeah.
Now, you've done a lot of participatory farmer breeding too, Lisa. Can you talk to your experiences with that?
Absolutely. It's kind of square one when we're restarting a local economy in wheat or any other type of food, figuring out what growers need and what millers need and what bakers and other processors need and what consumers want in their product, right? On a very local and regional scale. So we approached it with talking to all of those people and interviewing subsets of them and saying, okay, what are you looking for, right? And how is this different? And what is not being met in current varieties or production practices that are out there? So after interviewing growers in the Northeast, we found out that for winter wheat, most of those growers were, a lot of them, the organic growers, were selling to artisanal bakers in the end, you know, milling systems that would go to these small scale bakeries for a lot of sourdough type breads or higher value breads that are made in a way that's very different from the industrialized bread system. And therefore their needs were different. And they had very few varieties that had been adapted to their climate and their growing systems that could produce good bread. So that's where we started for most of our breeding programs in working with farmers. And we also found out that, you know, weeds were a main challenge for spring wheat for organic growers on the production end, and decided to really tackle those two main issues to breed something that would be better for growers and the whole processing chain for local wheat.
What does that look like when, of course, you have some examples of what you were doing, Julie, in France, and then from the historic record there, you can understand a bit of the traits of wheat. But what does it literally look like when the participatory breeding is happening? Is this happening in a lab? Is this happening in the field? Is it both?
Typically, what we would do in France, and this has obviously continued, I haven't been there since 2011, so the program has evolved, is still going on. What we did was we asked farmers about parental varieties they thought would be good that might be adapted, except for maybe they lodged too much or they had one kind of fatal flaw. Maybe they didn't yield enough. They would choose two parents that they thought would make a good combination. We would do the cross in a greenhouse or in a high tunnel at the research station and multiply that first generation of seed, because you don't get very much seed from the cross. And the cross itself is fairly technical to do. The seed from that would then get sent back to the first farm, that the one that had requested that cross, and it would be evaluated for a couple years on that farm while we had a limited quantity of seed. And then if it was doing well, it would be shared with other farms. We also had some regional hub farms that had access to smaller scale equipment for planting smaller plots of wheat. And we would plant all of the different crosses and populations on that farm for other farmers to come look at. And they could potentially request to try one of those populations on their farm and do selection there. So then all those selection actually happens on the farms. And what that entails is the farmer walking through the plots, they might choose one family over another. So say this cross worked really well, they might keep that one and drop a cross that didn't look good after a couple of years. They might also go into a single population, a single cross, and decide they wanted to keep certain types of plants, and they could pick the heads of the types that they liked and keep that seed and move that forward. What we would do as a research team would be to take measurements so that they could see if their selection was having an effect in comparison to the original population or check varieties, and we would do all the data analysis. So we would do some of the quality testing in the lab, and then we would return the results to the farmer so that they could make decisions about selections. They would produce the seed because they had to learn how to produce seed anyway to grow these varieties since they weren't commercially available. Once it got up to a large enough quantity, they could do that with their own equipment. And so that is kind of how the program worked. Once a variety was well known by a number of farmers and stable, it would get a name and then could be shared more in the network. But the Rizos Montspaysan itself would maintain ownership of that variety. So it wasn't commercialized. It was just available to members. And that was largely due to the regulations in the EU. There was no plan to commercialize a variety that was created through this participatory process because there was no path for it to get through the testing and registration process.
When you were talking about the quality testing that you would do, can you describe, was it protein and characteristics like that that you were looking at, Julie?
Yes. Yeah, so we did some protein tests on small quantities using some lab equipment. And then we would also do measures like grain fill. So that's 1,000 kernel weight. So that would be how well the grain had filled out. Most of that was on a kind of very small sample size because they would be the selected spikes from one plot or two plots, and then we would be sending them back the seed. So we didn't do any destructive tests like grinding it up for flour on the selected seeds. Later on, we would work with bakers to do some quality testing on actual flour from a population that had been selected over several years, because at that point you have enough grain that you can use some of it for flour. You don't have to plant it all back the next year.
Lisa, what did this look like as you started to put things into place in the Northeast?
Yeah, pretty similar to Julie's. And Julie really set the structure for this and I enacted it. So she brought a lot of knowledge from the experience over in Europe for us to really duplicate that effort. And, you know, it starts with interviews, like I mentioned, talking and learning needs to best structure the parent populations that would be useful for those growers' needs, bakers' needs, millers' needs, et cetera. And then establishing these families out there of crosses between often old wheats and new wheats, like Julie mentioned, or new wheats and new wheats, or old and old, whatever we thought would be interesting to try. And finding some really great growers to work with who, you know, had an eye for innovation and are willing to take the extra step to grow these experimental lines out on their farm and be really observant, but also have an experience, you know, with wheat and understand what they're looking for in a particular variety. Then working closely with those growers over the season and visiting plots, especially during harvest when growers are so busy, but we need to harvest the material, right? And helping find ways researchers can assist with the busyness of the season and collecting research material and data when growers can't do it because they don't have time. And yeah, we had a probably more unique program for spring wheat and weed competition than what the growers in France had. Yeah, Julie, I'm not sure. I'm guessing most of those are probably winter wheats there, but please correct me if that's wrong. So
yep, they were all winter wheat.
There you go. Yeah. So spring wheat's a little bit different. And in our colder climates where spring wheat is much more common, either due to frequency of the winter wheat dying in those climates or for other reasons for rotations, growers use spring wheat, and spring wheat under organic is really tough for wheat competition. And so we tackled that problem on farm, and I thought that was really our most successful of the on-farm breeding program, because a lot of organic farms have pretty good weed seed banks. So we put out these experimental families of wheat on these farms with high weed pressure, and they would see what progeny would compete and what families would compete well, and then select the best that could tolerate very high weed pressure. And we selected new lines from that, and we're still testing those, and some are looking really good relative to Czech. So we're hoping maybe to release some lines from that in time. So I think that was a unique aspect of what we did for on-farm breeding here, was targeting spring wheat, and we're excited about the results. But we also did a lot with winter wheat in a very similar way to what Julie described, where a subset of very innovative growers would put these families of wheat crosses out there and select based on whatever they were looking for. And it was kind of tailored to each farm. And then we would help out where we could in the lab by, you know, taking some of those back, screening for things like stem diameter, if we wanted to reduce lodging, or high protein that you can't really screen on a farm on a small scale. So that's where the collaboration between a farmer and researcher can be really powerful to develop something that's better.
So Lisa, all of these type of small regional grain economy projects, are they so directly involved with the farmer of necessity, in contrast to a place where there is an official wheat breeder?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think all good breeders are highly in touch with growers and talking with them and getting grower needs. But where you have a very, you know, centralized and industrialized food system, you typically have a grower organization that is going to maybe provide that feedback, right? Like the Wheat Growers Association or something. And so I just think the mechanism of communicating with growers and understanding growers' needs is a little different. Often breeding programs can be supported by commodity money that's coming from those growers as well, which taps, you know, the needs of growers into a conventional breeding program. But for us, since we're dealing with organic growers that are a very small portion of farmers in the United States or even in Europe, and these local grain economies that are also small compared to how much bread is produced overall in the country, we have to hunt a little bit more. There aren't necessarily organizations that bring these farmers together. And so it's our effort then to reach out directly to those growers, understand their needs, and incorporate them within a breeding program that's not serving a system that's very organized and consolidated. And anything to add on that, Julie?
Yeah, I think that's a good description. I think one of the reasons that it's really helpful to do participatory trials in this kind of system is because often the university doesn't necessarily have research stations that represents the range of environmental conditions. And so having on-farm trials is very useful. And having growers that have a lot of experience with organic, they know what actually performs well on their farm. But it is a learning process for both the grower and the breeder, in terms of the grower hasn't necessarily done selection before in a population that's genetically diverse, and the breeder hasn't necessarily worked on organic farms and doesn't necessarily know what to look for in the same way that they pretty much know what they're looking for when they're doing selection on a research station. There's also the benefit of having the growers involved is that there's then demand for the seed coming out of a program. If there's a variety that's commercialized, the organic seed market can be pretty small. And so it's a big risk for a company to take to decide to produce organic seed of a variety, not knowing how big the market is. And so having on-farm trials and growers that say, yes, this variety works for me, helps build that market and make it less of a risk. I think one of the things we're doing now in the Midwest is on-farm trials of some of the advanced lines from this program that Lisa's been describing, to make sure that they are competitive with the current checks, the best commercially available varieties, and that they have really good baking quality, so that we'll have that data to provide to other growers who might not have been involved at the beginning, but might want to purchase seed of that variety and try it out on their farm. I think there's also a philosophical reason to involve more farmers as we move towards local grain economies, because those economies tend to be more collaborative in general and less hierarchical. And so involving farmers in all the stages of the research means that they are engaged in the process of developing the varieties and not just in deciding whether an existing variety works for their system. But that's not exclusive to organic. There are many breeders who do bring growers in to be part of research decisions. I just think that it is one more reason to involve growers beyond just the practical necessity of having more eyes and more environments to make good selections.
So what research is happening? Like, are there some winter wheats in the ground right now somewhere in the Midwest that people are keeping an eye on?
Yes. So we have trials at the West Madison Agricultural Research Station in organic conditions and at the Spooner Agricultural Research Station with Lucia Gutierrez, who's the cereals breeder here. We also have on-farm trials at Meadowlark Organic and at Janie's Farm. So one in Wisconsin and one in Illinois. There's also a trial in New York still at Tor Oshner's Farm. And the varieties that are on those on-farm trials are the most advanced of the lines that we have, the best performing over multiple years. And we really want the farmers to help us decide whether they're worth releasing. In addition to those trials, we've also done some baking trials. Madison Sourdough here in Madison hosted a baking trial this past March with the advanced lines that are in on-farm trials. And we also had bakers participate from Origin Breads, and that's in Madison, Bard Breads in Viroqua. We had bakers from Chicago and Minneapolis participate as well. And so we're trying to make sure that the varieties we release work for artisanal bakers who are interested in buying local wheat. They work for the farmers that are going to be growing them. And we're doing testing in the lab on protein. We're measuring fusarium head blight resistance and the DON levels. And one of the benefits, I think, to having Cornell involved with the screening and with Lisa's project is that they have a fusarium head blight testing nursery, and that's a major challenge to the production of food grade grains in the Midwest, is this disease that causes a toxin that actually can affect humans. And so the level permitted in food products is very low. And so we're able to do some screening with a inoculated nursery with environmental conditions that actually make the disease pressure extremely high to select varieties that are more tolerant to that. We're benefiting from many years of research and breeding in the Midwest to Northeast on fusarium tolerance in winter wheat and in spring wheat.
Lisa, can you describe how your work overlaps and doesn't overlap with Julie's right now?
Yeah. Julie is very much seeing this forward. So the group has received some new funding from the USDA Organic Research and Extension Initiative to take this to the next level. So we've been generously funded through that program in the past and through the SARE program to do this work. And so, you know, breeding is a long process that takes, you know, variety evaluation at the beginning to see what are good parents to make crosses from. And then breeding programs take, you know, 10 plus years to release a variety usually. You got to cross parents and then keep growing them, testing progeny, and then finally testing advanced lines to see which ones do best in many different environments and applications.
It's not just wheat that's getting researched for these artisanal contexts, even though that's really key, bread being a big driver. There's a lot of research going on across the country with hullless barley and perennial wheat. Other things that you guys know about that would appeal to this same farm channel in terms of seed research?
Yeah, so the projects that Lisa mentioned, like she said, we were first funded by Northeast SARE to start the wheat breeding. And Then we're also funded by the ORAI program of the USDA for the trials. The USDA ORAI program has given more money to this regional grains, value-added grains work, and that includes not only wheat, but other food-grade grains, and that's led by Mark Sorrells at Cornell University. And then ORAI has funded the work on food barley, so naked barley that is easier to use for food uses. The project also includes work on malting and animal feed with barley, and that is led by Oregon State University. And then the Kernza work is expanding as well. We have Valentin Picasso here at University of Wisconsin-Madison, who's working on Kernza, as well as collaborators at the Land Institute and Minnesota. And we're excited to do more quality testing on Kernza and barley, as well as the quality testing on the wheat lines that are nearing release. Those projects are collaborating on a Grains Week online event in May. If people are interested in learning more, there'll be talks and other demonstrations for anyone who's interested in learning more about food grade grains.
That's great. Lisa, do you have anything you'd like to say in closing about this wonderful world of participatory breeding and seed seeking in wheat?
Yeah, well, we're hoping to get the lines to growers, right? None of this matters if they can't have a better line available, either through programs like the Open Source Seed Initiative or as a PVP variety. So we're doing our best to try to make that happen and get some better varieties out there, and always excited to hear feedback from growers if they're looking for something or want particular traits to be incorporated in the program, but are lacking in what they're growing at the moment. Yeah, and then I'll just put in a quick plug for most grain growers have a diverse rotation in organics, right? And the use of cover crops in those rotations is increasing too. And so a big piece of what I do now is with cover crop breeding. So we're looking at the covers that are used to support wheat in rotation. So that's also exciting and looking forward to serve those growers and bakers and millers out there.
That's great. Julie, do you have anything to say in closing?
Just echo what Lisa said. And if anyone is interested in learning more or getting involved, please don't hesitate to contact me. We are often short on seed for on-farm trials, but if you are interested in being a tester for some of these varieties, please do let me know. As seed levels increase, we'll probably be looking for that. If you are a baker or an enthusiast and want to be involved in the quality testing aspects, also please let me know, because we do have bake trials and then we have public taste testing of the results, which is always fun. So please get in touch.
Thank you, Julie Dawson and Lisa Kissing-Cusick, for joining me today for this Moses AGC talk on seeds.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Amy. Really appreciated the conversation and enjoyed it.
Thanks to Alyssa Hartman, Amy Halloran, Lisa Kissing-Cusick, and Julie Dawson for the inspiring work they are doing and for sharing their insights on this podcast. Keep an eye on this feed in the coming weeks for more partnership episodes with AGC on food-grade grains, including on diversified crop rotations and the milling process. And thank you for listening to the Moses Organic Farming Podcast. Moses educates farmers in sustainable and organic agriculture. Call the Organic Answer Line to ask a specialist about organic farming and certification at 888-90-MOSES or visit mosesorganic.org/ask. One of our specialists is Carmen Fernholz, who is a leader in growing organic food-grade grain in the Midwest. All of our farmer specialists can talk to you about everything organic farming related, including grain, vegetables, fruit, all kinds of livestock, beekeeping, organic certification, food safety, marketing, urban farming, land access, and more. These services are available in English, Hmong, Spanish, Swahili, and Somali. If you have any questions about today's episode or have ideas for future episodes, please contact me at chuck@mosesorganic.org. Our theme song is Summer Fields by The Tenements. Thanks again for listening.